Wünschst du dir jemanden, der dich versteht wie kein anderer? Jemand, der deine Wünsche wahr werden lässt und mit dir das schönste Abenteuer deines Lebens erleben möchte? Die Commerce-Plattform Shopify revolutioniert Millionen von Unternehmen weltweit. Mit Shopify richtest du im Nu deinen Online-Shop ein. Ganz ohne Programmier- oder Designkenntnisse. Dank der effizienten Einrichtung und intuitiven Social-Media- und Online-Marketplace-Integration kannst du über Instagram, eBay und Co. werben und verkaufen. Neue Zielgruppen zu erreichen war noch nie so einfach. Shopify bietet auf einer einzigen sicheren Plattform alle Tools, um dein Online-Business aufzubauen. Kostenlos testen und dein Business der Welt präsentieren. Shopify.de/try besuchen. Einfach Shopify.de/try eingeben und loslegen. Made for Germany. Powered by Shopify. Wünschst du dir jemanden, der dich versteht wie kein anderer? Jemand, der deine Wünsche wahr werden lässt und mit dir das schönste Abenteuer deines Lebens erleben möchte? Die Commerce-Plattform Shopify revolutioniert Millionen von Unternehmen weltweit. Mit Shopify richtest du im Nu deinen Online-Shop ein. Ganz ohne Programmier- oder Designkenntnisse. Dank der effizienten Einrichtung und intuitiven Social-Media- und Online-Marketplace-Integration kannst du über Instagram, eBay und Co. werben und verkaufen. Neue Zielgruppen zu erreichen war noch nie so einfach. Shopify bietet auf einer einzigen sicheren Plattform alle Tools, um dein Online-Business aufzubauen. Kostenlos testen und dein Business der Welt präsentieren. Shopify.de/try besuchen. Einfach Shopify.de/try eingeben und loslegen. Made for Germany. Powered by Shopify.
For some reason, some absolute weapon of a man built a water slide in the middle of the North Sea. Me and the lads on the cod trawler couldn't believe it when we found it. There we were, bracing ourselves against 40 feet rogue waves and horizontal sleet carried on hurricane-level turbulence 50 miles out of Scotland when we spotted it. An 8-looped, baby blue plastic water slide standing defiantly amongst the building-sized waves and ship-bucking winds. It had a ladder and little white and red flags for a lifeguard and everything. It was Gaz who saw it first. "Well, damn," I muttered under my breath. "That is a water slide." "Is that a bloody water slide?" Old Dave, the captain, had poked his head out of the cabin to get a view uninhabited by the fat drops of rain smashing into the viewing window. "Bloody hell. My God, it actually is. That's a damn water slide in the middle of the North Sea." He joined the rest of us, running from the wheel under the deck to lean over the starboard bulwark. Every man in the vessel stood, gawping at the horizontal blue loops, those steel bars set into concrete, standing firm against a lashing of wind and monstrous waves. Even the tiny lifeguard flags and the tiny bucket they were in seemed unperturbed by the North Sea's rage. This was in stark contrast to the nets and gears on the ship deck, all of which strained at the straps, saving them from being lost at sea. The search beam on the roof's cabin swung in the concrete plinth's direction, carving it out against the almost unscathed Arctic darkness. I turned around, peering to see who had climbed up to direct it. That's when the ship capsized. It happened in 3 moments. The mother of all surges crashed down. I was in the air above churning foam. All was black, and my lungs filled with ice water. We had life jackets, of course, but in seas this rough, the buoyancy offers little help. Fortunately, this wasn't the first time I'd found myself in the drink. Adrenaline let instinct take charge, and I became singularly focused. Swim. Swim and don't look until you reach that damn water slide. The constant flashes of lightning were my only guide. Somehow, though, I made it to the concrete platform. My lungs burned from inhaling so much of that sub-zero salt water. Those freezing waves still smashed around me as I climbed the steel rungs bolted to one side of the structure. It was when I got to the top that I was allowed a lightning strike snapshot of our ship's stern vanishing below the churning surface. The gale was still beating down on me. There were no signs of my crewmates, but I dare not risk standing to look for them in the roaring black waves. The force of those winds would no doubt have carried me straight back into the freezing waters. Instead, I rolled towards the only thing I could see on the platform besides a blue plastic water slide. A hole, about 10 feet in diameter, in the center of the concrete space. I was terrified by the time I reached it, but only by the memories of Mick or Benny or Saul's mum's weeping faces when they found out their boys had drowned. I'd sworn never to do that to my old dear. That's why I only peered into the gaping, ladderless hole for a few moments before deciding this unknown danger was far less than the known certainty of the enraged North Sea. The lightning-carved silhouette of a fresh 30-footer bearing down on the platform was all it took for me to close my eyes and throw myself into the yawning void. The Arctic overspill from above fell through the darkness with me. We weren't falling for long. After about 10 minutes, my plummet was broken by something soft, cold, and clothed in wet fabric. It crunched beneath me when I landed, despite the distinctly moist squelching nature of the way it cushioned my landing. It took me a few minutes to find a flare in the safety kit on my belt. Even though the echoing from the tunnel mouth on the distant ceiling made the roar of the waves louder than ever before, I still heard the high-pitched scream that could only have come from my own mouth. It couldn't have come from Bob or Fred's. Their necks were broken. That's why discovering I'd landed on them made me scramble as far back into the flare-lit room as I possibly could. I screamed even louder when Gaz came falling through the hole. "Who the hell is screaming? Keith, mate, is that you? What have I landed? Oh my god, is that a big pile of... Gaz? Gaz, move away from the damn hole!" For a man with a moniker that contains the words big and fat, Gaz could move fast when he needed to. This is an essential skill for any fisherman, as nobody wants to be decapitated by a snapped line. Another life-saving skill is knowing when to follow instructions without stopping to look around and find out why. It's both of these skills which saved Gaz from being crushed by the falling frames of Dave and Alfie. Dave landed safely on the pile of sodden corpses. The organic snap which cracked the air let us know Alfie had joined them. "What a damn storm," Dave grinned at us, before the grin turned into a scream upon noticing the puddle of blood forming around where a sharp piece of bone protruded from the new unnatural joint in Alfie's neck. "Jesus Christ, Alfie, no! Wait, is that Bob? Dave, just move!" It was Gaz that yelled this time, still only a yard or two from the hole himself. Dave showed the same intuitive response that kept Gaz alive, rolling from the corpse pile mere milliseconds before the thick boots did to Fred's skull what they would have done to his own. "I want to go home," Nathan whimpered, upon seeing the red mess of bone and brain on his thick rubber footwear. "I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to..." He was snapped out of his panic jabbering by his own neck snapping. Jim rolled off of him and the other bodies, already panicking from the realization of what had just happened. By the time a few minutes had passed since the last of my former crewmates had fallen to their death, there were only four of us standing. Me, Gaz, Dave and Jim. Four bodies lay in a pile, leering at us through dim red lights of the flare. The rest never made it out of the waves. "Lads," Gaz eventually managed, once we'd all stopped screaming. "Where the hell are we? What in God's name just happened?" "We capsized and we all swam for the water slide. Then we fell down a hole," I heard the words leave my lips, rather than consciously deciding to say them. I was still in shock, my grip on the flare trembling and my gaze fighting hard not to be drawn to the pair of glistening orphaned eyes peering at me from a few feet to my right. "I have no clue why it's here," Dave said slowly, his thousand-yard stare locked on Fred's mangled skull. "But I'm so glad we found the water slide. I've been on these ways for nearly 40 years. I know the sea, and I've never seen her this angry. It was a blessing. But still, something isn't right." "Well, no duh, Dave, something isn't right. Are you high? Of course something isn't right. You don't just find a water slide in the middle of the North Damn Sea." Jim was slapping the back of his hand into his palm to emphasize each word of the last sentence. He was the youngest of us, and this was clearly shown in the additional layers of terror present on his face. I wasn't in a state to acknowledge it at the time, but he was doing well, considering he was also dealing with his first brush with drowning. As I said though, I wasn't exactly in a fit state to recognize this. "Shut up, Jim, and show some damn respect. You have no idea what you're talking about." of the man and boy. The boy was struggling, but the man was very obviously broken. So was I, though, which is why I ignored my instinct and turned to Dave. So, what do we do? The wide-eyed man, whose kind, wrinkled face was usually so warm, was the least qualified at the moment to lead us. We followed him anyway. All I knew was that I was cold, in pain, and terrified. Dave's ramblings may have just been lunatic gibberish, but they were maniacal nonsense from an authority I recognized. Had I been a bit more with it, we'd never have gone into the door marked Nursery, Strictly No Entry. We'd been stumbling around wide, unlit, concrete corridors for about 6 hours when we found it. The deep groaning from the metal beams lining the walls constantly reminding us that, outside dark passages, there was nothing except inky ocean blackness and whatever monstrous things it contained. Aside from the pile of bodies, the room we'd fallen into was quite bare. There was a light switch and a bulb hanging from each corner of the ceiling, but despite Jim's frantic switch flicking, they wouldn't sputter into life. The same went for the switches in the corridors he'd periodically try, despite Dave's increasingly aggressive insistence he'd leave them alone. The floors of the room and hallways were lined with red tiles. I don't know what color they actually were, but the glow from the flare left them all rendered in a deep, flickering mosaic of scarlets and crimsons. There'd been lines of drains, the kind you find at swimming pools, to filter the seawater overspill from the hole in the ceiling. Clearly, there was some kind of power in the facility, as Jim could hear the distant sucking and gushing of a pumping system when he put his ears to one of the plastic grates. That's why Jim suggested we follow the pipes leading left at the first split of the corridor. Dave disagreed. Dave decided we should keep following the rail. It was hanging from the ceiling, kept in place by thick steel cables drilled into the concrete every few feet or so. The rail started at the very lip of the hole, then ran along the dripping ceiling into the dark corridor that sprawled forth from the room's only exit. It was constructed from 3 stainless steel plates arranged in a rigid arc, housing a thick chain exposed on its underside. This quietly clinking and clanking length of equally rusted iron rivets was looped around large wheels set directly below each ceiling cable. My mind couldn't help but conjure up images of slaughterhouses and abattoirs, of gutted beasts turning slowly on meat hooks as a conveyor belt rail carried their corpses to the grinder in irregular, shuddering bursts. I think Jim's mind was conjuring similar images, which is why he didn't stop pleading with us to turn back as we followed the rail further and further from the source of the gurgling water pump sounds. There was definitely power somewhere in this place, even if none of the light switches dispelled the darkness. The doors we found at various points were all sealed with electronic keypads whose illuminated fingerprint scanners created small glittering oases of false hope as we traversed deeper below the waves. Jim kept trying these keypads until Dave's harsh reprimands grew into threats of violence. It was when we reached the empty lobby or landing and the rail disappeared into a steel hatch above the door signposted as the nursery that Dave started delivering on his promise. "Ow, what the hell, man?" Jim was looking up at the three of us, a streak of dark red pouring from the nose that Dave had just broken. Dave's blood-covered fist was still shaking when he replied. "I told you, shut the hell up. We're following the rail. The rail will lead us out. Right, Gaz? Keith?" Dave's newly wild eyes flickered between us in quick succession. Gaz smirked and nodded furiously, his face in a grin betrayed by his tearful eyes and trembling jaw. My nod was slow and accompanied by a gulp. I don't know whether it was the twitching, the flecks of spittle in his grey beard, or the way Dave's tongue would occasionally dart across his lips like a reptile, but it was beginning to dawn on me that I'd backed the wrong horse in the power struggle between youthful ingenuity and old age's wisdom. "No, you shut the hell up, you crazy old man. We've been down here hours, and this rail leads us to the damn nursery. Why would the way out be in a..." The rocky trawlerman never got to finish his sentence. The steel-capped toe of Dave's boot smashed into the boy's chin, knocking him sideways into the cement wall. There was a dull crack, accompanied by a jet of dark red spraying at the impact point where hair, flesh and bone met cinder block. Jim's head bounced off the wall. He looked up at me, blood pooling from his split skull, eyes crossing in and out of focus.
"Keith, mate, please."
The lump in my throat rose. The message to step forward and put myself between the helpless teenager and the madman we'd mistakenly elected to lead was only halfway home when Dave responded for me. I screamed for the first time his heavy boot came down. Gaz was holding me back for the subsequent 24 stomps Dave delivered. His aging knee rose up and down again and again, stamping on Jim's head until the dull squelching thuds were replaced by muted cracks and snaps of splitting bones, and then the wet smacks of rubber and blood-slicked tiles. Jim's helpless and now headless body had stopped twitching long before Dave finished. "What the hell, Dave?" I screeched, struggling helplessly against Gaz's pudgy grip. "What the actual hell are you doing, you madman? He was just a kid." Behind my tear-stained eyes, all I could see were panic-fueled visions of Jim's mum, of me having to explain that I'd allowed a psychopathic near-pensioner to stamp on his head until his brains were splattered across the rubber overalls of two grown men who should have saved him. "Oh, Keith, do you have the balls now, do you?" Dave snarled, rounding on me. The wildness in his eyes had evolved into red blemishes around burst capillaries. "Funny, I don't remember them when you got back to shore and walked in on your brother screwing your wife." Now, I wasn't just seeing red because of the flare. Before I could free myself and slam a fist into Dave's face for bringing up this known taboo subject, Gaz revealed just how much he also didn't appreciate the comment.
"You don't bring that up," Gaz roared.
He threw me to the ground, stepping over me and slamming a paw into Dave's jaw with one fluid motion.
"You know we don't bring that up. That could have been any one of our misses."
It still amazes me that Dave breaching an unspoken code amongst men who spend time away from their wives was what snapped Gaz out of his panic. He'd seen a young man have their head pulverized and said nothing. As it was, I was too shocked at the sudden ferocity with which Gaz sicked himself on Dave to do anything but watch, jaw dropped and eyes almost wide as Dave's. For his part, Dave was too busy being repeatedly punched in the face by the obese man sat on his chest to comment on the situation.
"You don't remind us that they cheat."
Gaz punctuated each word with a fresh blow to Dave's face. From my viewpoint on the floor, I couldn't see its condition, but by the way the old man's blood-covered boots stopped kicking and flailing painted a clear enough mental image. When Gaz eventually stood and I saw that the truth was much closer to the remains of Jim than I'd imagined, an irrepressible wave of nausea rose up in my gut.
"Christ, Keith, don't get in on my boots."
Gaz was crouched over me, his fat palm hammering my back in an effort to help me clear the last of my vomit. I was about to respond, to make some half-terrified wisecrack about the mess he'd made with our former captain, when a noise made us both yell and look into the deep red shadows above. There was a loud, metallic thunk, accompanied by the squeak of unoiled wheels and the clink-clank of rusted iron. The chain in the rail was moving. "Gaz?" I stammered, pulling myself to my feet and staring at the hatch above the door, marked, "Nursery, strictly no entry."
"Gaz, mate, we need to go."
When the lobby was suddenly illuminated by a bright light from the space beyond the metal hatch, Gaz started vigorously nodding in furtive agreement. For some reason, though, our feet didn't get the message. Both of us remained rooted to the spot, each waiting for the other to grab us by the shoulder and yank us into a full-pelt sprint away from those parting steel hatch doors. Before either of us had the chance to muster up the needed courage, however, the rail mechanism above lurched his cargo forward with a screeching jolt. The hatch burst open. I screamed. Gaz started crying. The steel hatch door swung closed with a deafening clang, plunging the room back into near darkness from my last flare. Something was dangling directly above us, hanging from the conveyor chain by a hook piercing the large fin at the end of its thick, veiny tail. It looked almost like a walrus or manatee, if somebody had decided to turn a walrus or manatee skin inside out and stretch his neck about 4 feet. Another notable difference was the excess amount of long, bony fins jutting from its bulbous stomach. It had thrice as many as any known species of marine mammal. The spidery flippers wriggled and twitched excitedly as the scent of the dead man's blood reached the three flowing nostrils on its back. At first, I thought it must have been looking my way, because I couldn't see its face in the almost unpermeated red darkness. When the tip of the fleshy tube that was its neck started to peel back, I realized, to my unending horror, that I was mistaken. The thick trunk of his neck jutted and spasmed, the loose folds of glistening skin on its surface retracting to reveal a long, yellow snout. By the time the wrinkled hood was stripped back, I realized the slowly spinning thing never had a neck to begin with. The quivering neck was actually an elongated head submerged beneath a fold of skin. Well, I thought it was elongated. Once the vertical slits along its jaundiced surface started peeling open, however, I knew I was mistaken. It was flat. I was still screaming and wishing for the kickstart from Gaz that would never come when the flesh petals began to unfurl. For the 30 or so seconds it took for the starfish-sized limbs to prise themselves apart, our screams were undercut by nauseating slurps and squelches which perfectly matched the viscous mucus dripping from its newly exposed flesh. Our screams only got louder once the face of this monstrosity could be seen in its full glory. Each of the seven trembling face segments had three eyes running along its length. These eyes were round, bright, dancing independently of each other, and they sized up this unexpected meal. They were also distinctly human. They alone weren't what made my legs turn so numb I fell on my ass, though. No, it was the mouths. It had three of them, arranged on a triangle in a flat, tongue-like pad at the epicenter of the writhing 21-eyed gaze. The space between the maws was occupied by an unfamiliar orifice that oozed a pus-coloured substance. This discharge caused hissing and steam to rise from the floor tiles by Gaz's feet where it pooled. These mouths, also human and full of molars, knocked all hope of survival from my mind. I wept uncontrollably, shaking in the warm puddle of the other men's blood and my own urine where I lay. It wasn't the look of the mouths that broke me, despite the fact they were utterly horrifying in ways, in a way that tests my nerve to ruminate on too long. It's the fact. They were talking to one another.
What's this? What's this? What's this? What is it the eyes bring us? It is filthy smalls, is it? I see filthy smalls. Yes, yes, yes. They want to play, they does. Yes, yes.
They conversed in sing-song voices devoid of any dialect I recognized. What I did recognize, the thing that horrified me so much about those understandable yet unintelligible words, was that the voices that uttered them belonged to human children. Gaz was still standing. I think that's what saved my life. That's why it went for him first, giving me the few seconds I needed to run screaming into the dark corridor away from this living nightmare. Before either of us could move, the air was cut through by a noxious odor. The stench curled the hair in my nostrils and sent my gag reflex into violent spasms. Working on a cod trawler, I thought I'd smell the worst shades of rotten ocean flesh the sea could send. I realized in an instant that I knew nothing of the stomach-emptying horrors she could spew forth, and she was now punishing me for my overconfidence. The punishment her tittering judge meted out on Gaz was much, much harsher. Neither of us had any time to react to the smell beyond starting to gag. The orifice between the mouths had puckered, the acrid acidic pus leaking from it now cascading from the pursed hole. I just about noticed the change when it convulsed, opening to spray forth a thick yellowish web of phlegm over Gaz. He started screeching the moment the pus-coloured snot touched his skin. I could see why. As soon as contact was made, his flesh started bubbling, melting away to reveal veins, muscles, and eventually bone. The jabbering thing above had landed a direct hit. Gaz just about had time to run in my direction, arm outstretched, his remaining eye wide and full of tears, when the jaw he wanted to use to cry for help fell onto the floor.
We both watched it fall for a moment that seemed an eternity long. Me with my unrestrained panic and mouth full of bile. Gaz with his exposed throat and flopping, jawless tongue. By the time I found my way to my feet, his arm had gone too. By the time I'd started running down the unlit corridor, his corroded body had collapsed under its own weight, the remaining eye still darting wildly in the few seconds before the last part of his head dissolved into foul-smelling organic sludge. I shouldn't have looked over my shoulder. That mental image and its implications will scar me for whatever does remain of my life. I also shouldn't have dropped the flare. If I hadn't been running through the corridor in pitch darkness, the scientists with the night vision goggles would never have been able to tackle me and drive that syringe into my neck. I've been in the cell ever since I woke up. I don't know what happened to my clothes. They've been watching me since then too. The scientists, I mean. They've been poking and prodding me with needles for weeks, treating me like a damn pincushion while they inject serums and take samples. I'm in no condition to fight them. Some of the syringes contain a sedative that keeps me drowsy. They must do, because they always seem especially keen to stick on in me when I get a bit, as one of them put it, restless and screamy. It was the one with the kind face who said that. The lady one. Can't be older than Jim. I think she's some kind of intern. It's her that brings my admittedly not too bad meals, which are always steak, eggs and beans. She's also the one who brought me the crayons and paper I'm writing this on. She wouldn't let me have a pen. Too pointy, she said. When she brings my next meal, I'm going to beg her to take this. Plead with her to put it out there somewhere, so my family knows what happened. I know Hannah left me for Jack, but I still want her to know. Little Ian deserves to know what happened to his dad. Even if she doesn't get my message out there immediately, I hope the kind-faced scientist takes my advice and stores this away instead of throwing it out, just in case she ever had a change of heart about whatever the hell they're doing to me. I'm going to have to stop writing soon. I'm tired, my neck aches, and I've got these cysts on my sides that have been there for a few days now. I'm sure it's just the meat diet, but I've been getting big, like Gaz big. I'm hoping it's nothing to worry about, though. I've got other problems than my health, like getting the hell out of here. Oh, and before I go, I did ask the kind-faced scientist about the water slide. She just smiled at me and said, "Oh yeah, I see why that must have seemed weird. You'll find out soon enough, Keith, but during the larval stages, you can get a bit, childlike. We find taking the newer converts up top and letting them go for a swim and use the slide helps them burn off a bit of excess energy." She leaned in closer after she said this, her face locked in an effort to offer genuine reassurance. "Don't worry, Keith. I know the nursery seems scary, but I'll make sure the others give you a turn on the slide."